So I don't know if you watch the news an awful lot or just a little bit, but I came across something the other day that was unbelievable. Throughout the Bible, it talks about God's wisdom and our wisdom. And this was really, I'm going to show you now, this rusty pole, Fraser. So there we are. This is a rusty pole in Exmouth. Now, is anybody privy to this story? Because this was news to me. So this is a rusty pole in Exmouth, and it was on the 13th of April, the water company decided to remove this rusty pole. This was originally built in 1909 as a vent to a sewer. So they removed the rusty pole, and there was an outcry in the town. Okay, this is a news report from a local newspaper in Devon. So as I say, up in 1909, the affection that the rusty pole has gained over the years has seen it become number 7 on the TripAdvisor's top things to see when visiting Exmouth. Number 7. It's not there now, it's about number 21 because I looked. But actually, number 7 of top things to see in Exmouth. It also even has a society and a Facebook page upon its honour. The Rusty Pole Society was formed on Facebook by people who regularly walk past the pole. And the group has attracted more than 250 followers. Local historian Mike Merritt, also PR officer for the Rusty Pole Society, has criticised a lack of consultation, campaigning for the return of the Rusty Pole. Now, you know, you may feel that, you know, we learn that for some people, the gospel seems foolishness. But I think we've got an awful long way to go, haven't we, if we're in Exmouth. So, but there is a serious side to this, because you bring up the next one, Fraser. And the next one, there's one with the blue sky. That one there. I don't know if you can quite make it there, but people are bending down and worshipping the rusty pole. It is, we're in a bit of a state, aren't we? So when I was preparing for this, the title of it is, Are You All Right? Are You All Right? And as I was preparing for this, it came to my sort of thoughts that it's quite a miracle that I'm standing here in front of you today. Now, not the sort of the recent events that's happened to me, but my dad, when he was a child, he was born in 26, so around 1930s or something like 1935, he was playing in his garden. And he his father used to do a lot of gardening. He was a railway man, and gardening and railways and stuff seemed to go together. So he had a water butt. This water butt was collecting water off the roof. And my dad, at a very young age, was looking at his reflection in the water butt, fell into the water butt head first. The water butt was so deep he couldn't get out. It was so big and heavy he couldn't move. Thankfully, his neighbour, who was doing a washing up in a kitchen, noticed these legs sticking out of the water butt, went across and pulled him out. Now, if that neighbour hadn't been there doing a washing up, I wouldn't be here. Another time, and then he went into the Royal Navy at the age of 18. He was in the Pacific near an island of Okinawa. I don't know if anybody's seen Hacksaw Ridge, but he was in that area with kamikaze planes. So he may not have survived that, and I wouldn't be here. And then when I was about 10 years of age, I was actually in our house. We had was originally built as a coal cellar, but ended up as a storage room. He came onto the back of the kitchen, and some of the brickwork wasn't complete, and there was a hole in the brickwork. But behind the hole in the brickwork, which was inside the kitchen, was a cupboard. And we thought it was great as kids. We could go in this what was a coal cellar, shout through the hole, and somebody in the kitchen would think there's somebody in the kitchen, but there wasn't anybody there because we were outside shouting through the brick wall. And When I did this one day, I had a boiled sweet in my mouth. And as I was shouting, it got stuck in my throat. And I wasn't coughing or anything like that. It was way beyond coughing. It was completely stuck in my throat, this boiled sweet. Now, my dad used to work, as I later found in my 20s, sometimes 100 hours a week. He wasn't there very often. But thankfully, he was there that day. Now, my dad was really quite a strong guy, because for 10 years, he was a fireman shoveling coal on steam engines. So upper body-wise, he was really strong. And he just grabbed me, picked me up by the legs with one hand. And not many people could do that. My mum certainly couldn't have done it if she was just there. And hit me on the back. And the sweet, I can remember it as if it was yesterday, hit the back of my teeth. So we are so much, we receive everything we have. We receive everything we have. So I was looking around thinking what I should be speaking today a few weeks ago now. And I came across this book on my bookshelf. And much to my embarrassment, this book's been sitting there for years on my bookshelf. And I've never looked at it. Now, this is my kind of book because there's not many pages in it. It's to the point. It's easy to read. And it's by a guy called Timothy Keller, which I believe a lot of people probably will know the name. So who is he? He's 72 years of age. He ran a large church in New York for 30 years. I think it was in Manhattan. And it was a Presbyterian church. And during lockdown, unfortunately, he's been diagnosed with cancer. He's having treatment and he's still writing books. And he's still going strong, thankfully. So this book is actually, it's a great book, and it has some life-changing information in it. I think it really is quite tremendous. And it goes through three main topics. It says, the natural condition of the human ego, the transformed sense of self brought through the gospel, how to get transformed sense of self. Now I'm going to put my money where my mouth is. So if you want one of these books, or you're completely and absolutely confused about what I'm talking about here, if you sign up at the back, there's put up a sheet at the back, I will get one of these for you. All right. So if at the end of this 10-minute, 20-minute, or how long I'm going to speak for, if you think, what was he on about? It's anything important, but I'm not quite sure. This will answer it all. It's a bit of a sort of get out of jail free card. The passage on scripture that he actually is focusing on is 1 Corinthians verse chapter 3, verse 21 to 23, and 1 Corinthians 4, verse 1 to 7, Paul's letter to the Corinthians. They're having a few problems. So I'm going to read actually from 19. Can find it here, 19. For the wisdom of this world is foolishness in God's sight. As it is written, he catches the wise in their craftiness. And again, the Lord knows that the thoughts of the wise are futile. So then, no more boasting about men. All things are yours, whether Paul or Apollos or Cephas, and I believe that's Peter, or the word, or life, or death, or the present, or the future, all are yours, and you are of Christ, and Christ is of God. So then, men ought to regard us as servants of Christ, as those entrusted with the secret things of God. Now it is required that those who have been given a trust must prove faithful. I care very little if I am judged by you or by any human court. Indeed, I do not even judge myself. My conscience is clear, but that does not make me innocent. It is the Lord who judges me. Therefore, judge nothing before the appointed time. Wait till the Lord comes. He will bring to light what is hidden in the darkness and will expose the motives of men. At the time, each will receive his praise from God. Now, brothers, I have applied these things to myself and Apollos for your benefit, so that you may learn from us the meaning of the saying, do not go beyond what is written. Then you will not take pride in the one man against the other. For who makes you different from anyone else? What did you have that you did not receive? And if you did receive it, why do you boast as though you did not? So that's what this book's based on. So Paul, let's have a wee think about Paul. Paul is talking about self-esteem. And this is life-changing in this book, I think. So what is Paul like? So Paul describes himself as the chief of sinners in 1 Timothy 1:15. He says in 1 Timothy 1:15, here is a trustworthy saying and deserves full acceptance. Christ came into the world to save sinners, of whom I am the worst. And so that's in Timothy. That's after his road to Damascus. That's after his conversion. He says, I am the worst. He doesn't say I was. He says, I am the worst. So if we were to put a profile down for what Paul's like, so he's the son of a Pharisee. He's a Pharisee. He's a Roman citizen. He's a tent maker. He's a persecutor of the way, the Christian people of the time. Present at the stoning of Stephen, converted on his way to Damascus. And when he was on his way to Damascus, he'd got letters from the high priest. He was going to Damascus to round up some Christians to take them back to Jerusalem to get them sorted out. And what were the Pharisees like? One of the things I always comes to my mind is the pool of Bethesda, the 38-year-old man who's not been walking for a long time on his mat, and he's waiting for the angel to disturb the waters so he can get into the waters and actually be healed. But he's no way of getting into the water, so he's not healed. Jesus comes along and heals him, and it's on the Sabbath. So Jesus comes along and heals this man, and it's on the Sabbath. Now, if that was me and you, and this guy's been hanging around for 38 years, and you've chatted to him, you would have come across him, you would have known him, and the Pharisees would have known him. And if it was me, you would have said, wow, what's happened? You know, you'd say, that's amazing, look at your legs, you're moving around, what's going on? Well, this guy come along, and who's this guy? Well, I don't know, he just asked me, do I want to be well? And I said, yes, and this is what happened. Well, that's absolutely incredible. Great, yeah. How about me and you later on go for a jog? you'd be absolutely over the moon about the fact that this guy, 38 years, is now walking. But what did the Pharisees do at Sorry? And they would have noticed him. They would have known the guy. And he come up to him and said, why are you carrying your mat? Why are you carrying your mat on the Sabbath? You're doing work on the Sabbath you shouldn't be doing. Why are you carrying your mat? So this is the background that Paul's come from. So Paul has been moved from performing to get to heaven to having God's verdict. When we meet Jesus, when he met Jesus on the road to Damascus, he turned his whole life onto a different path. So the natural condition of the human heart, in Timothy Keller's book, Natural Condition of the Human Heart, it starts off with. So he's talking about the natural condition, and he's talking about the human ego. Ego meaning the sense of self-worth, I, the value, your importance. In chapter 4, verse 6 of Corinthians I've just read out, he uses a very unusual word. Paul uses a very unusual word for pride. In fact, in some translations, it's not pride that's there, it's puffed up. So normally throughout Scripture, you see the word hubris for pride, which means, you know, excessive confidence. But he uses the word phusio. And phusio is only used seven times in the whole Bible, five times in 1 Corinthians and twice in Colossians. So Fraser, could we have that wee picture? And this is what phusio means. Puffed up. That's what it means. All puffed up. And as I say, in some translation, it says puffed up. It doesn't use the word pride. So that's what it means. Now, Paul's the only person that uses this word. And as I say, it's only used seven times in the whole of the Bible. Seven times. So overinflated, puffed up, beyond its size. And it's related to the word of bellows. So being puffed up. So he says it's puffed up. And he says it's empty. The natural condition of the human ego is empty. There's nothing at its center. So throughout the book, there's various quotes from various people. So I'm just going to read out just what's in the book about this bit about being empty. Firstly, empty. The image points to the fact that there is emptiness at the center of the human ego. The ego that is puffed up and overinflated has nothing at its center. It is empty. And then he makes a reference to a guy called Soren Kierkegaard. In his book, Sickness Unto Death, Soren Kierkegaard says, it is the normal state of the human heart to try to build its identity around something besides God. Spiritual pride is the illusion that we are competent to run our own lives, achieve our own sense of self-worth, and find a purpose big enough to give us meaning of life without God. Matthew Henry puts it this way: spiritual pride is abominable. It is making use of the greatest favors of God to feed our own vanity and make idols of ourselves. To have a high opinion of our wisdom is but to flatter ourselves. And flattery is the very next step to self-deceit. This is heavy stuff, isn't it? So second thing he talks about, it's painful. So the ego is often painful because it has something incredibly wrong with it. The self, the natural condition of the human ego is painful because when you're walking around and you don't notice your ankle or your wrist or your back or whatever, unless it's painful. So this sort of background knowledge that there's something not quite right. So it's painful. The ego often hurts because there's something incredibly wrong with it, unbelievably wrong with it. Recently I was on holiday with Julie and we were packing up the caravan and we were just about to go and we were a bit late and we, you know, rushing around a bit. I had to be off the site by 11 o'clock and it was about 10:45 and stuff like this. And Julie went off to the washing up and stuff. And we had my son's dog with us. And she said to us before she departed, her last words was, "Don't run over the dog." You know, like, "Don't run over the dog." A ridiculous thing to say. Anyway, so was packing away and stuff like that. The dog was in his bed outside, right outside the caravan. And as I drove the car around to hitch the car up, I heard the dog, and he had a ground anchor and the lead to him, so he couldn't go too far. And I heard this screeching and howling, and I thought I'd run over the dog. And I expected to get out of that car and see a dog injured with broken legs running around. Oh, my heart absolutely sank. I didn't realize you could get so attached to animals. And but thankfully, he had more sense than I did and actually moved away from the car. And he was just bringing attention to himself, what's going on? So it was completely and utterly safe. But it was that sense of ego that was put me in that position of not listening. Don't run over the dog. But later on, the thing was, and I'll come to this later, I was so affected by it. I was thinking about it all the time. And I thought, well, this is... And I just thought... And Julie said to me, stop beating yourself up. stop beating yourself up. And I thought about it. I thought, right, okay, what would I do differently next time? Put the dog in the car. And then I thought, have I ever been maneuvering a car next to a caravan with a dog next... No, I've never done that. I've never done that. That was new to me. We were rushing. And I started to rationalize it and think, no, that wouldn't happen again. And it wouldn't happen again by putting the dog in the car. But it was my ego that led me into that trap. Don't run it. Oh, yeah. No, I won't run after the dog. So we frequently come across situations that challenge our senses of self. And Timothy Keller says that some people say, you've hurt my feelings. You've hurt my feelings. But actually, he says that actually it's your ego that gets hurt. Your feelings don't get hurt. It's your ego that gets hurt. So the other thing is the ego is busy, drawing attention to itself, trying to fill the emptiness with two things in particular, comparing and boasting. Comparing and boasting. C.S. Lewis, and this is a quote from, this quote's in this book. Pride gets no pleasure out of having something. Only out of having more of it than the next person. We say that people are proud of being rich or clever or good-looking, but they are not. They are proud of being richer or cleverer or better-looking than others. If everyone else became equally rich or clever or good-looking, there would be nothing to be proud about. It's a really, really good book. And lastly, it talks about the human ego, the natural human, is fragile. It can quickly be deflated or inflated. And then he quotes an example. Empty, painful, busy, and fragile. Let me give you a perfect example of this. I'm not trying to lift her up as being worse than other people at all. She actually shows tremendous amount of self-awareness and I have a lot of admiration for her. But if you want a perfect example of what I'm talking about, here is an excerpt from an interview with Madonna in Vogue magazine some time ago when she was talking about her career. What she says is this: my drive in life comes from fear of being mediocre. This is always pushing me. I push past one spell of it and discover myself as a special human being, but then feel I am still mediocre and uninterestingly, unless I do something else. Because even though I have become somebody, I still have to prove that I am somebody My struggle has never ended, and I guess it never will.
Wow.
So Corinthians are in a state of division because there's three people who are the elders there and or the evangelist in that area. You've got Paul, you've got Peter, and you've got Apollos. And they're all sort of jockeying for position, saying that Apollos is the guy to go with. He's a bit more up to date. Paul, he had that thing on the road to Damascus. He's the guy. He's the guy. So they're all kind of in a state of division. As Christians, though, when we believe, that moment, the verdict is cast. When we believe, that moment, the verdict is cast. You are my son, daughter, who I am pleased. And Jesus said on the cross, it was finished. As I've said before, Paul says that I am the worst of sinners. He was very aware of his moral flaws. Yet, incredible, he has such poise and confidence. I fall into the trap frequently when I've blown it, like with a dog, when I get it wrong. And I believe when I've blown it, I feel that I've put a gap between me and God. If only, and then I go down the road of, if only people knew what I was really like. This makes me feel down, think, what's the point? I feel unable to do God's will, and that I'm not all right. I fall into this trap. But Paul has confidence, and nothing seems to bother him. Why? Why does he have this confidence and we don't? Because we judge ourselves. We're in no position to judge ourselves. We don't have the qualifications to judge ourselves. There's only one person's opinion that really, really matters. So Paul knows about his sin, but does not count them to himself. And his identity. My identity and your identity as Christians is received. It's not achieved. His sin identity, his sin and his identity are not connected. His sin and identity are not connected. Neither does he see his accomplishments and congratulate himself. It's really interesting that modern day psychiatrists, this, I'm just about to read something out, was produced in 2012, are starting to come around to the fact that having a higher self-esteem is not a guarantee for success. And having low self-esteem is not a guarantee for failure. It's much more complex than that. And having high self-esteem sometimes can be more damaging to yourself and the people around you. So this is an article written by Heidi Grant, who's a psychologist, and does like write self-help books and stuff. If you look under the self-help heading on Amazon, you'll find roughly 5,000 books listed under the subheading self-esteem. The vast majority of these books aim not only to tell you your self-esteem might be low, but to show you how to get your hands on some more of it. It's a thriving business. Because self-esteem is, at least in Western cultures, considered to be the bedrock of individual success. You can't possibly get ahead in life, the logic goes, unless you believe you are perfectly awesome. It's a great word, isn't it? Awesome. And of course, you must be perfectly awesome in order to keep believing that you are. So you live in quiet terror of making mistakes and feel devastated when you do. Your only defense is to refocus your attention on all the things you do well, mentally stroking your own ego until it has forgotten this horrible episode of unawesomeness, and move on to something more satisfying when you think about it. This doesn't actually sound like a recipe for success, does it? Indeed, recent reviews of the research on high self-esteem have come to the troubling conclusion that it's not all it's cracked up to be. High self-esteem does not predict better performance or greater success. And though people with higher self-esteem do think they're more successful, objectively, they are not. High self-esteem does not make you any more effective leader, a more appealing lover, or more likely to lead a healthy lifestyle, or be more attractive and compelling in an interview. A growing body of research and new studies by Juliana Barnes, who's part of California University psychologist, and Sherina Shen, who's a professor in social psychologist at also the same university in California, Berkeley. So also suggests there's a better option. So Berkeley's Juliana Barnes and Sherina Shen suggested that self-compassion rather than self-esteem may be the key to unlocking your true potential for greatness. Self-compassion. Why is self-compassion so powerful? In a large part, it is non-evaluative. In other words, your ego is effectively out of the picture. Isn't that interesting? You can confront your flaws and foibles head on. Get a realistic sense of your abilities and your actions, and figure out what needs to be done to do differently next. So I've already said this, but it's good to repeat. Paul knows about his sins, does not connect them to himself and his identity. My identity is in Christ, and that is received. It's not achieved. His sins and identity are not connected. Neither does he see an accomplishment and congratulate himself. So how do we get the transformed view of self? Paul says, as I've said before, he's the worst of sinners. And he says, I am. He doesn't say I was. And he says that I care very little by you or by any human court. I do not even judge myself. My conscience is clear, but that doesn't make me innocent. That's an incredible statement, isn't it? My conscience is clear, but that does not make me innocent. And that innocent word is linked to the word justify. His clear conscience does not justify him. It's not about what he thinks about himself, not about self-esteem. Paul knows that he knows he cannot justify himself. Paul says the only opinion that counts is the Lord who judges him. Now, Christianity, amongst religions, is absolutely unique. Christianity is unique. It is the moment that you believe the verdict is in. So it's where you are at the time. An atheist may say that they get their self-image from being a good person, and they hope that eventually they will get a verdict that confirms that they are a good person. Performance leads to the verdict for the atheist. If you are a Muslim, performance leads to the verdict. Every day, you are in a court. Every day you're in a courtroom when performance leads to a verdict. because you are comparing yourself with others, you're worried about other people's opinion of you, and you're starting to criticize yourself, and you're starting to judge yourself, and you're in a courtroom, and you're actually having to deal with all these problems, and Paul isn't in the courtroom. He doesn't go in the courtroom. He's not there, and we shouldn't be there either. Paul is saying that in Christianity, the verdict leads to performance, not the performance leads to the verdict. So as Christianity, in Christianity, we have the verdict. Jesus says it's finished. Then out of that verdict, we then embrace all that God's got for us. But the other religions, you perform, and you never know if your performance is going to be good enough. And then at the end of the performance, you get the verdict. The moment we believe, God says, "This is my beloved son, daughter, in whom I'm pleased." So therefore, there is now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus, Romans 8:1. So therefore, there is now, as soon as you believe, soon as you accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior, there is no condemnation. There is no condemnation. It's done. It's finished. Live in the freedom that Christ has given you. So, as I say, I will have this. Please sign up at the back if you'd like this book, which would go into a lot more detail than I've done this morning. But I'll finish with this. It's an old hymn written by Martins Gray in 1851. He penned these words in 1905, which was a few years later the Rusty Paul went up. So, "Nought have I gotten but what I received. Grace has bestowed it since I have believed. Boasting excluded, pride I abase. I'm only a sinner, saved by grace." Thank you.